Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recent or forthcoming publications by faculty at Vanderbilt University. I'm Chris Benda, Librarian for Religious Studies and Theology at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with Myrick C. Chenal, Jr., Assistant Professor of Surgery and Medicine, about his recent article, The Social Condition of Lepers in the Gospels, published in the winter 2018 issue of the Journal of Biblical Literature. Ricky, thanks for being willing to do this interview with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're a surgeon and a professor of surgery. You're also a biblical scholar with a dissertation on the Gospel of Mark and the sayings source Q. One could assume that it's this combination of interests that led to an article on leprosy in the Gospels. Would that assumption be right, or what impelled you to write this piece?
Yeah, that's more or less a correct assumption. So my dissertation focused a lot on the miracle accounts in Mark and the saying source, and healing of people with leprosy was certainly some of the miracles that I looked at. But it was also sort of spurred by, you know, the fact that I am a physician, and while I was doing my graduate work in New Testament, sort of thought to myself, well, the biggest disease that they ever talk about in the New Testament is leprosy. And so if I'm going to be a biblical scholar and I'm a physician, I should probably find out as much about it as I possibly could. And so it was really just that sense of kind of obligation of these two roles that I have of knowing about this that led to me coming to the conclusions that I write about in the article.
Okay. You argue, quote, that exegetes need not and indeed should not read the stories of Jesus' healings of lepers in light of a general social exclusion of the leprous or a specific taboo against touching them, unquote. And you're fairly careful, as I think we'll see, in your characterizations about how lepers were treated throughout the Second Temple periods. Just to start off, what are you not claiming about leprosy during this period?
So in terms of what I'm not claiming, yeah, is I'm not claiming that people with leprosy had completely unfettered social access, or that being categorized as a leper in the Second Temple period was not somehow a big deal or potentially important to people. So what I am arguing against is the what I think are sometimes too facile assumptions about the degree of exclusion or the degree of stigma that leprosy carried in Jesus' society.
Mm-hmm. You begin your argument by looking at how Jewish sources outside the New Testament, both legal and narrative, treat leprosy. And a central legal source is the Hebrew Bible, specifically some passages in the books of Leviticus and Numbers. And I'm going to read these passages because I think these are kind of key to how people have interpreted leprosy in the Second Temple period in the Gospels as well. Leviticus 13:45-46 reads, "The person who has the leprous disease shall wear torn clothes and let the hair of his head be disheveled, and he shall cover his upper lip and cry out, 'Unclean, unclean.' He shall remain unclean as long as he has the disease. He is unclean. He shall live alone. His dwelling shall be outside the camp." And then a Numbers passage, Numbers 5:2, reads, "Command the Israelites to put out of the camp everyone who is leprous or has a discharge, and everyone who is unclean through contact with a corpse." So how and why does your reading of these passages differ from the way most other scholars have understood them, and how do you see the other legal and narrative sources you examine confirm this argument?
So I think that the difference that I take is I am a little more cautious in saying how these texts, which were written hundreds of years before Jesus' time, would have then been taken to apply to the situation of first century Jews in Galilee or the rest of Judea. So, for instance, if you listen closely to both of those passages, they presume that the Israelites are living in the camp during the Exodus period, which makes sense because that's when the setting of Leviticus and Numbers. However, it then becomes a matter of interpretation of once you're no longer living in a camp and you live in settlements and have jobs and have a more sedentary society than is what's envisioned in the Pentateuch, how is that going to apply? What does it mean to exclude lepers from the camp if you don't live in a camp anymore? And the point that I was trying to make in the article is you can't a priori say how people would have interpreted that. You could have seen a very restrictive interpretation where you say, well, this applied to the camp, but we don't live in a camp anymore, so it doesn't apply at all, versus a very expansive interpretation where you say, well, any place that Jews might live anywhere it functions now as the camp, and therefore they have to be excluded everywhere. And so my argument is really that these two texts in and of themselves don't tell you what Second Temple Jews would have done. You have to look at what Second Temple Jews wrote and said, and to the extent that we know, to really figure out how they would have treated people who were considered to have leprosy. And so the kind of countervailing arguments that I use is looking at some of the narrative materials in the rest of the Hebrew Bible, and also some other Second Temple materials, that when you see people talking about people with leprosy, sometimes they're talking about excluding them, but the exclusions are not always sort of consistent of what the degree of exclusion needs to be or where you're excluded from. And then sometimes people talk about leprosy and there's not really any valence of exclusion to it. And so really the argument is that it's likely that any practice of a group is going to vary across time and space. And in the sources, we see some variation across time and space. So you can't simply take the writings of, for instance, Leviticus, and then say, well, this is how they would have been interpreted in Jesus's time and place based on some universal law of how these were interpreted.
Right. And you can't even, I mean, with you talk about Josephus. I mean, you can't even take somebody necessarily who lived around the time of Jesus and make these kinds of claims.
That's right. I mean, in Josephus, in a number of his works, we'll talk about leprosy, but he also talks about it in different ways. And in some places, it seems like there are restrictions for leprosy that apply really just to Jerusalem. But in some places, he seems to expand it out more broadly. But even within his work, it's not necessarily one consistent picture of exclusion of people with leprosy that you see. And the other thing with Josephus is that one of the polemical agendas that Josephus had was to argue against Gentile historians who had said that Moses himself had leprosy, and that's why he was an outcast in Egypt. And so Josephus has a rhetorical incentive to make restrictions on leprosy amongst Jews sound as extensive as possible so as to disprove the fact that the basically founder of Judaism from the legal perspective himself had leprosy.
Right. So then you turn to the discussion of leprosy in the Gospels. And one of the things you mention is something you call heads I win, tails you lose exegesis. So what do you mean by that, and how is that type of exegesis countered by your approach to these narratives?
Yeah, this is, it's sort of a term that came to me as I was reading all of these different exegetes talking about leprosy, and gets back to this variability that I found when I looked at the text. And essentially what would happen for the most part was that whenever there was anything that could be remotely construed as being exclusion in a text about someone with leprosy, the exegetes would say, well, see, here's the exclusion of the lepers, and this is what Jewish society was like. But any time there wasn't, then the exegetes would essentially make this the exception that proves the rule. And I think this becomes most clear in the Gospel of Luke, where you have two different stories of Jesus healing someone with leprosy. In one story, Jesus touches the person to heal their leprosy. And in the other story, it's actually 10 people with leprosy stand at a distance, and Jesus heals them from a distance. So you'll have the same exegete reading the first story and saying, well, this story is really about the boldness of Jesus and this person in overcoming this societal taboo against contact with people with leprosy. And then they'll read that second story as showing, well, this is how strong the taboo was, that Jesus couldn't even get this close to them. And so it sets up a situation where you can't disprove the hypothesis. If both evidence for it and both evidence against it count as evidence for it, then you're in this, you know, no-win situation, or no-lose situation, I should say. And it just came to my mind, oh, this is like, you know, when Bugs Bunny or the Three Stooges tries to get someone to bet on a coin flip by saying, heads I win, tails you lose, mm-hmm. and setting up that situation where no matter what happens, you're right.
Right. So what are some of the reasons that you found that lepers in the Gospels have been viewed in the ways you've critiqued in the article, and why do such views persist?
Well, I think one sort of more benign reason is that any type of scholarship is going to default to a position of assuming that there's some sort of system in place, because systems allow you to take disparate pieces of evidence and put them together to create a picture. And so in the bulk of Jewish literature that we have, by volume, there's not a whole lot about people with leprosy in those, you know, in the hundreds to thousands of years of literature that we have. And so you get little sort of snippets here and there. You get the couple verses from Leviticus or the verse from Numbers, and then you get some mention, you know, here and there in the Hebrew Bible, and then later in the rabbinic literature. And if you have all of these little fragments sort of floating around and you want to talk about them, it's really helpful to assume that they are part of a coherent system that coheres over time, so that your fragment from 1,000 years later can inform your interpretation of the previous fragment, and it gives you something to talk about, mm-hmm. other than saying, well, we just don't know because we don't have enough evidence at any one time to make a conclusion about it. So that's one reason, I think, is it just gives people something to talk and write about, and scholars need things to talk and write about. But I think there's a second, less benign explanation going on here, and I think that it is partially because one really easy and I would say lazy way that Christians try to make Christianity seem good is by contrasting Jesus to some cartoonish version of contemporary Judaism around him. And so the worse that you can make his surrounding Jewish culture look, the better you make Jesus look just by doing things that aren't horrible, right? And so if these leprous characters in the Gospels are living wretched lives of social exclusion, then the fact that Jesus even acknowledges them is somehow remarkable and points out, you know, how remarkable Jesus is and how remarkable the ethic that Jesus teaches is. And then I think a third explanation that kind of goes along with that is that if you make these stories of Jesus healing the lepers about overcoming social exclusion, that's a much more resonant message today than if you make it about a person performing some supernatural act of healing, which is, you know, sometimes pretty hard for us to digest and find meaning in, especially in, you know, sort of more, I would say, liberal areas of the academy who are going to be more suspicious of supernatural explanations for events. If the real point of the story is not that Jesus has this supernatural healing power, but that Jesus fosters inclusivity, that's a lot easier message to make resonant in the world today, especially if you're trying to talk to people who don't really think that miraculous healings happen. So I think all of those things really coalesce to make these readings attractive, and I think that's why they have had such staying power. Even though what I argue in the article is that when you actually look at the evidence, it's a little bit that the emperor has no clothes.
So is there anything you'd recommend as a way forward to minimize these kinds of problematic interpretations?
You know, I think that the biggest issue, and that I'm sort of speaking from a Christian perspective, and this is more kind of in the idea of how these are read in churches and in non-academic settings, is to really try to get away from rhetorical strategies that are based on contrasting a good Jesus with a bad Judaism. And I think that as I sort of reviewed a lot of this literature to write this article, I could see sort of a creep as we moved further and further away from sort of rigorous academic writing on this to more and more writing that was kind of lay engaged. And, you know, many of the scholars that I criticize who I think are reading some of these things incorrectly are much more measured in their sort of interpretations but I can see more lay oriented literature that I read that's clearly referring to some of this academic work, but it then takes off a lot of the restraint that even those had placed. And so I think that's part of the problem too, is that even the work that I think is wrong, I think it is wrong but careful. But then I think it becomes wrong and careless as people get a little more freed from the constraints of having to adhere to footnotes and that sort of thing.
Ricky, thank you again for this conversation. Again, I've been talking with Ricky Chanel, assistant professor of surgery and medicine, about his recent article, The Social Condition of Lepers in the Gospels, published in the winter 2018 issue of the Journal of Biblical Literature. We'll have a link to a copy of this article on the Vanderbilt Divinity Library's website, but unfortunately it's only going to be available to those who have their own subscriptions to the Journal of Biblical Literature or those affiliated with institutions that have such a subscription. And if you don't fall into one of those categories, check with your local library about how you might get a copy of the article. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.